Random House Audiobooks presents Eat the Rich by P.J. O'Rourke. Read for you by the author.
Eat the Rich. I had one fundamental question about economics. I wanted to know why some parts of the world are rich and others suck. It's not a matter of brains. No place, with the possible exception of Brentwood, is dumber than Beverly Hills, and the residents are wading in gravy. Meanwhile, in Russia, where chess is a spectator sport, they're boiling stones for soup. Nor can education be the reason. Fourth graders in the American school system know what a condom is, but aren't sure about 9 times 7. Natural resources aren't the answer. Africa has diamonds, gold, uranium, oil, you name it. Scandinavia has little, and it's frozen besides. Maybe culture is the key. But wealthy regions, such as the local mall, are famous for lacking it. Perhaps the good life's secret lies in civilization. The Chinese had an ancient and sophisticated civilization when my relatives were hunkering naked in trees. Admittedly, that was last week, but they've been drinking. In 1000 BC, when Europeans were barely using metal to hit each other over the head, the Chinese were casting ornate wine vessels big enough to take a bath in, something else no contemporary European had done. Yet today, China stinks. Government does not cause affluence. Citizens of totalitarian countries have plenty of government and nothing of anything else. And absence of government doesn't work either. For a million years, mankind had no government at all, and everybody's relatives were naked in trees. Plain hard work is not the source of plenty. The poorer people are, the plainer and harder is the work that they do. The better off play golf. And technology provides no guarantee of creature comforts. The most wretched locales in the world are well supplied with complex and up-to-date technology in the form of weapons. I didn't see an obvious answer to my question. Why are some places wealthy and other places poor? It occurred to me at last that this might have something to do with money. But I didn't know anything about money. I didn't know anything about money as a practical matter. Did I have enough of it to make the mortgage payment? And I didn't know anything about money in the broader, more abstract sense. I certainly didn't know anything about economic theory, and I wasn't alone in this. I couldn't answer the central question of this discussion because I was an economic idiot. I got to be an economic idiot by the simple and natural method of being human. Humans have trouble with economics, as you may have noticed, and not just because economic circumstances sometimes cause them to starve. Humans seem to have an innate inability to pay attention to economic principles. Love, death, and money. These are the three main human concerns. We're all keen students of love. We are fascinated by every aspect of the matter, in theory and in practice. From precise biological observations of thrusting this and gaping that, to ethereal sentimentalities marketed in miles of aisles at Hallmark stores. No variety of love is too trivial for exegesis. No aspect of love is so ridiculous that it hasn't been exhaustively reviewed by the great thinkers, the great artists, the great hosts of daytime talk shows. As for death, such is the public appetite for investigation of the subject that the highest-rated television program in America is about an emergency room. The dullest mind can reason extensively about what causes kicking the bucket. The most hard-headed and unspeculative of persons has his notions of eschatology. Dying sparks our intellectual curiosity. But money does not. All we care about is the thing itself, preferably in large amounts. We care a very great deal about that, but here our brain work stops. We don't seem to mind where our money comes from, and in an affluent society, we don't even seem to mind where our money goes. As for larger questions about money, we shrug our shoulders and say, "I wish I had more." Why is it that we are earnest scholars of amorousness and necrosis, but we turn as vague and fidgety as a study hall in June when the topic is economics? I have several hypotheses, none of them very good. Love and death are limited and personal. Even when free love was in vogue, only a certain number of people would allow us to practice that freedom upon them. A pious man in the throes of Christian agape may love every creature in the world, but he's unlikely to meet them all. And death is as finite as it gets. It has closure. Economics happens a lot more often, and it involves multitudes of people and uncountable goods and services. Economics is just too complicated. It makes our heads ache. So when anything economic goes awry, we respond in a limited and personal way, by searching our suit coat pockets to see if there are any wadded up fives inside. Then we either pray or vote for Democrats depending upon our personal convictions of faith. Or maybe economics is so ever-present, so pervasive in every aspect of our lives, that we don't really perceive it. We fail to identify economics as a distinct entity. We can watch a man slip and fall and almost never hear him say, "Goddamn gravity." And so it is with economics. No amount of losing our jobs or our nest eggs sends us to the library for a copy of John Maynard Keynes' The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. Constant money worries have a bad effect on human psychology. I'd argue there's more unbalanced thinking about finance than about anything else. Death and sex may be the mainstays of psychoanalysis, but note that very few shrinks ask to be paid in murders or marriages. People will do some odd things for political or religious reasons, but that's nothing compared to what people will do for a buck. And if you consider how people spend their dough, insane hardly covers it. Our reactions to cash are nutty even when the cash is half a world away and belongs to perfect strangers. We don't ridicule people for dying, or in our hearts despise them for fooling around. But let a man get rich, especially if it happens quickly and we don't understand how he did it, and we can work ourselves into a fit of psychotic rage. We aren't rational and intelligent about economics because thinking about money has driven us crazy. I'm as much of a moon calf as anyone. I certainly had no interest in economics as a kid, as kids don't. Children, lucky children at least, live in that ideal state postulated by Marx, where the rule is, from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. Gulags equal getting grounded, dad in high dudgeon is confused with Joseph Stalin, and then we wonder why so many young people are leftists. I had no interest in economics at college either. I belonged to that great tradition of academic bohemia, which stretches from the 15th century riots of François Villon to the fish tours of the present day. For university hipsters, there is nothing more pathetic than taking business courses. My friends and I were above that. In our classes, we studied literature and unglazed pottery. We were seeking, questing, growing. Specifically, we were growing sideburns and leg hair, according to gender. It did not occur to us that the frat-pack dolts and the tridelt tweedies hurrying to get the Econ 101 on time in their square fashion were the real intellectuals. We never realized that grappling with the concept of aggregate supply and demand was more challenging than writing a paper about the effects of cool jazz on the poetry of Edgar Allan Poe. If the rah-rah Bobs and pin-me Sallys had been taking love or death courses, we would have been right there with them. But money was a different matter. We weren't interested in money. Actually, what we weren't interested in was work. And, of course, we were interested in money. I remember we'd get excited whenever we had any. It's just that we were determined not to earn it. We would never go in search of money. Money was something that would come looking for us after we'd choreographed our world-shattering modern dance recital or mounted our famous empty gallery show of preconceptual post-objectivist paintings, or when our folk rock group Exiles of Dayton learned to play Kumbaya, and we weren't going to sell out no matter how much money was lavished upon us. Business majors intended to, and it was a loaded phrase in those days, make money. And they were going to do this even if it involved some activity that wasn't a bit artistic, such as running IBM. We artsy types would have been shocked if anybody had told us, and nobody had the nerve, that making money was creative. And we would have been truly shocked to learn that a fundamental principle of economics, that wealth is created when assets are moved from lower to higher valued uses, is the root of all creativity, be it artsy, IBMZ, or whatever. I turned into a square myself, of course, as everyone who lives long enough does. I got a job as a journalist, but without ever considering that journalism was a business, although I would have been unpleasantly surprised to get a hug instead of a paycheck at the end of the week. And I continued to ignore economic issues, even though I had a press pass to the most spectacular extravaganza of economics in this century. It was the 70s, and the economy was changing almost as often as bed partners. The Great Depression may have been more dramatic, but it was a one-trick pony. In the 70s, globalization suddenly included the other three-quarters of the globe. The places that used to make our wind-up toys were making our automobiles. Everything was being imported, except oil, which had hitherto been given away free with a windshield wash and a set of highball glasses at most brand-name gas stations. Then one day, you couldn't buy oil for money. Not that there wasn't plenty of money around, it just didn't happen to be worth anything. The gold standard had disappeared from the scene. Maybe it joined a cult. International currency exchange rates were determined with mood rings. The most powerful nations in the world had, at their helms, an amazing collection of economic nincompoops. Nixon, Carter, Mao, Harold Wilson, George Pompidou, Leonid Brezhnev. And the computer and electronic media revolution was just starting, so that bad ideas about economics were beginning to spread around the world at neuron speed. I dozed through it, and I was covering politics, too. Even I realized that money was to politicians what the eucalyptus tree is to koala bears. Food, water, shelter, and something to crap on. I made a few of the normal journalistic squeaks about greed and self-interest, and I let the thing slide. It wasn't until the 90s, when I'd been a foreign correspondent for 10 years, that I finally noticed economics. I noticed that, in a lot of places I went, there wasn't anything you'd call an economy. And I didn't know why. Many of these countries seemed to have everything, except food, water, shelter, and something to crap on. I decided to go back to the econ texts I'd finessed in college and figure things out. And my beatnik loathing returned full-blown. Except this time, it wasn't the business majors I despised. It was the authors of the books they'd had to study. It turns out that econ professors are economic idiots, too. Looking into a college textbook as an adult is a shock, and a vivid reminder of why we were so glad to get out of school. The tone varies from condescension worthy of a presidential press conference to sly chumminess worthy of the current president. No idea, however simple, for example, when there's more of something it costs less, can be expressed without rendering it onto a Madras sport coat of a graph and translating it into a rebus puzzle full of peculiar signs and notations. And then, speaking of matters economical, there's the price of these things, $49.95 for a copy of Economics by Paul A. Samuelson. Now, Economics is one of the most commonly used texts on the subject, the book with which current leaders of business and industry were afflicted in school. And here's another shock. Professor Samuelson's almost as much of a goof as my friends and I were in the 60s. I quote him, "Marx was the most influential and perceptive critic of the market economy ever." Influential? Yeah, influential, definitely. Marx almost caused World War III. But perceptive? I don't know. I mean, Samuelson continues, "Marx was wrong about many things, but that does not diminish his stature as an important economist." Well, what would if Marx was wrong about many things and screwed the babysitter? It's not reassuring to learn that the men who run the companies where our 401ks are invested have minds filled with junk from the attic of Paul A. Samuelson's Economics. The textbooks aren't good. This sent me back to the original source material, the classics of economic thought. But here I must admit, as I was tacitly admitting 30 years ago, that I don't have the brains to get into Tridout. The Wealth of Nations, Das Kapital, the general theory of whatchamacallit, impressive works, and they look very important on my bookshelf, but they put me to sleep faster than the economic news of the 70s did. Now, there are, of course, popular books on economics, but the really popular books are about extraordinary people doing extraordinary things and getting fabulously wealthy or going to jail, preferably both. I was interested in ordinary people doing ordinary things and getting by. And the less popular but more worthwhile books on economics all seem to presume that I'd made it through something like Samuelson without blowing a fuse. So I gave up trying to be smart about economics. I decided if I wanted to know why some places are rich and other places are poor, I should go to those places. I'd visit different economic systems, free market, socialist, and systems nobody can figure out. I'd investigate economically successful societies, the United States, Sweden, Hong Kong, and economically unsuccessful societies, Albania, Cuba, Tanzania. I'd poke around, look things over, and simply ask people, "How come you're so broke?" Or, "Why are you shitting in I-cotton?" On my last day in Shanghai, I went to an open-air antiques market. Junk market, really, with flimsy booths containing a few old vases and bracelets and lots of Mao buttons. I found a poster from the Cultural Revolution showing sturdy figures with chins uplifted in that "who cut one" Marxist sort of pose. The woman in the booth pointed to the date on the poster, 1966, and wrote the price on the back of her hand, 100 yuan, or renminbi, people's money as the yuan is now called, about $12.50. A small and bent old man walked up. He had a few teeth and thick glasses. "Would you like a translation?" he said. The poster headline reads, "Revolutionary students must unite with revolutionary farmers and participate together in plural cultural revolution in the countryside." I gave the woman in the booth 100 won. "No, no," said the old man. "You should have bargained with her." "Well," I said, "it's guilt money. When that poster was printed, I thought I was for Mao." The old man laughed, and then he said, "Oh, yes. Because I had been sent to a Japanese school during the occupation, I was exiled to the country." "That must have been no fun," I said. "How I suffered," he said. "But Mao was a great man." "You really think so?" "But he was dictator too long. He did many harmful things. He did..." The old man paused and thought about how to put it. And then the old man summed up the entire history of government evil in the realm of economics. "Mao did too much," he said. We're so close to being rich. Everybody in the world could be rich as hell. The benighted masses of India could quit peddling bicycle rickshaws and start dragging Learjets through the streets of Calcutta. Indians in the Brazilian rainforest could be singing in the rain. The endangered fauna would wear thong bikinis. Save the girl from Ipanema. Eskimos could give up clubbing baby seals and devote their Arctic vastness to building an Olympic-quality ice dancing team. When we're all wealthy, Sally Struthers will be featured in magazine ads headlined, "You can send this child to summer weight loss camp, or you can turn a page." Care packages will contain oyster forks and truffles, and altruistic musicians will hold benefit concerts to raise enough money to pay the Rolling Stones to retire. Money won't solve all our problems, but money will give us options. Let us choose the problems we want to have. Leisure conglomerates may open franchises in Bosnia where Muslims and Serbs can blast each other in paintball wars. Self-destructive individuals will still exist, but instead of dying from drug overdoses in pay toilet stalls, they'll be able to expire in luxury at the Chateau Marmont like John Belushi. The Taliban fundamentalists might continue to keep women in seclusion, but they could do so by opening a Bergdorf Goodman's in Afghanistan. They'll never see those wives again. All this is possible because the modern industrial economy works. Obviously, it works better in some places than others, but it works, even in some of the poorest places. African countries like the Ivory Coast now produce almost as much per capita wealth as the United States did when the Monroe Doctrine was declared. And Egypt produces more. America did not consider itself a poor country in the early 19th century, and in fact, at that time, it was one of the world's most prosperous nations. Until the Industrial Revolution, economic growth was paltry. Measured in 1990 dollars, the world gross domestic product, the value of everything produced on Earth, went from $565 per person in 1500 to $651 in 1820. That was an increase in wealth of about 27 cents a year for over 300 years. But after the Industrial Revolution, something wonderful happened. The total world GDP grew from $695 billion in 1820 to almost $28 trillion in 1992. This planet had the same amount of arable land in 1992 as it had in 1820, and arguably fewer natural resources. Plus, population had grown from a little more than 1 billion to nearly 5.5 billion. But even so, world GDP swelled from $651 per person to $5,145 per person. Prosperity increased by $26 a year. Wealth has been growing 100 times faster than it did before the industrial age. The modern economy works, and we know how to make it work better. Free markets are extremely successful. Even a free market with lots of tax baggage and regulatory impediments is much better than a market that isn't free. Sweden has about the same amount of arable land as Cuba, a similar range of natural resources, a worse climate, and a couple million fewer people. But Sweden's GDP is more than 11 times the size of Cuba's. We know what to do, and we know how to do it. So what's wrong with the world? To a certain extent, it's the same thing that's wrong with me. Because the prosaic, depressing, and somewhat shameful fact is that the secret to getting ahead is just what my parents told me it was. The whole miracle of the modern industrial economy is based upon the things that our folks were trying to drum into our heads before we went off to college to grow sideburns and leg hair, or as the modern case is, get nose rings and neck tattoos. It's the advice we received at the dinner table while the Jell-O dessert puddled and our friends were waiting for us at the mall. It's the clumsy set-piece speech our parents made and the heart-to-hearts they'd spring on us when we were really stoned. It's what we heard in capital letters when we brought home grades that looked like a collection of Baywatch bra cup sizes or wrecked the car. Hard work, education, responsibility, property rights, rule of law, democratic government. Actually, most parents didn't get all those items into the lecture. In fact, I've never heard of a parent saying, "Listen here, if I catch you running around without property rights again, I'll take away your cell phone." But when our parents said, "Be honest," they were assuming that property rights are real. And when our parents said, "Obey the law," they were making a logical inference that the law exists and that it merits obeying. And many of our parents had served in the military, defending democracy, and would remind us of this at length. Of course, by hard work, our parents didn't mean that we should be doing the hard things that constitute work for the poor people in the world. Few parents hope that their children will carry 40-pound buckets of water on their heads. Our parents wanted us to do hard work that was intelligent, fulfilling, and promised advancement in life. Although they also wanted us to mow the lawn. The hard work was linked to education. However, billions of people don't have a chance to get an education. This is one reason that dinner table parental advice is difficult to apply to the Earth's impoverished masses. There are also billions of people who don't have property rights, not to mention property. Or the property rights are arbitrary and the property can be taken by anybody with a gun or a government title. These billions of people have trouble being responsible because being responsible means thinking of the future. They haven't got one. Rule of law is crucial. And it has to be good law. Thus, if what our parents told us is going to be globally effective, mom and dad will need to bring world leaders into the dining room. All the presidents, prime ministers, dictators, generals, chairmen of idiot political parties, lunatic guerrilla chieftains, and fanatical heads of crazed religious sects will need to squeeze around the imitation Queen Anne mahogany veneer with extra leaves in and get a real talking to. Then there's democracy to be considered. Democracy is a bulwark against tyranny, unless a majority of the electorate gets tyrannical. People can vote themselves poor, as the Swedes seem to be trying to do. So, all the people on the planet are coming over to the house. And when they get there, what they're going to do is exactly what we did. They're not going to listen. There is a worldwide pig-headedness about money. There is a willful and even belligerent ignorance concerning ways and means. There is a heartfelt and near-universal refusal to understand the basic economic principles behind the creation of wealth. Not all this ignorance is irrational. Some people profit from economic privation. Economists, for instance. John Maynard Keynes couldn't have become a big shot guiding government intervention in business and finance if it hadn't been for the Great Depression. And Alan Greenspan is a success because we all lost our wallets in the 1970s when inflation scared our pants off. We fear the power that others have over us. And wealth is power. We're afraid that Kathy Lee Gifford is going to make us sew jogging suits for 30 cents an hour. But are the rich really scarier than the poor? Take a midnight stroll through a fancy neighborhood. Then take a midnight stroll a few blocks from the U.S. Capitol. Sure, we can get in trouble in Monte Carlo. We can lose at roulette. We can get suckered into a shady business deal with Princess Stephanie's ex-husband. But we're more likely to be mugged in the District of Columbia. Not that we should begrudge the crimes of those poor people. They're just practicing politics on a small scale. If they listened to their own political leaders, they'd put down the gun and pick up the ballot box and steal from everybody instead of just us. Political systems must love poverty. They produce so much of it. Poor people make easier targets for a demagogue. No Mao is likely to arise on the New York Stock Exchange floor. And politicians and democracies benefit from destitution, too. The United States has had a broad range of poverty programs for 30 years. Those programs have failed. Millions of people are still poor. And those people vote for politicians who favor keeping the poverty programs in place. There's a Matt Drudge conspiracy theory in that somewhere. Many religions claim to admire poverty. and some religions even advocate the practice of being poor, although all those religions seem willing to accept large cash donations. You'd think businessmen, in search for new customers, would always be opposed to impecuniousness. But Kathy Lee Gifford is not alone in depending on destitute workers to take pay-nothing jobs. Finally, general poverty benefits specific wealth. If most people are broke, that's great for the wealthy few. They get cheap household help, low ancestral manor real estate prices, and no crowds at the beach. This explains the small, nasty plutocracies in impoverished countries. Maybe it also accounts for the rich socialists prominent on the political landscape for the last two centuries. I began this tape by asking why some parts of the world are rich and others are poor. And I naturally had prejudices about what the answers would be. I favored the free market, not because I knew anything about markets, but because I live in a free, or nearly free, country. And I'm a free man, as long as I call home frequently. And it works for me. I was skeptical about the ability of politics to deliver economic benefits, because I did know something about that. I've been writing about politics at home and abroad for years. I had a low opinion of the trade and its practitioners. And I considered culture as an economic factor to be a joke. How is ballet going to make the earth wealthy? I was stupidly surprised to find out how important law is. Law, of course, derives from politics. And a political system is ultimately a product of a society's attitudes, ideas, and beliefs, its culture. Which brings me back to the free market. I started out looking at the free market in terms of its effectiveness, its efficiency, as an economist would say. I ended up looking at the free market as a moral device. My initial prejudice was right in one respect. The most important part of the free market is the part that's free. Economic liberty cannot be untangled from liberty of other kinds. You may have freedom of religion, if the rabbi can get off night shifts on Fridays. You may have freedom of assembly, but where are you all going to go if it rains? The U.S. Constitution is, at least I hope it is, a statement of American cultural values. The First Amendment implies a free market. Six of the remaining articles in the Bill of Rights defend private property specifically, and two of the others concern rights reserved to the people, some of which are certainly economic rights. We are a free market nation, though the electors and the elected sometimes forget it. A belief in the free market means a belief that people have an innate right to the fruits of their endeavors and the right to dispose of the fruit the way they see fit, as long as other people don't get pasted in the face with a rotten peach or something. There are people who don't believe this. Some of these people are just bad. They steal. Some of these people are nationalistic and think it's okay to take things from other people if they live more than a peach toss away or speak another language or have a different religion or look funny. And the kings and emperors who ruled mankind during most of history were under the impression that everything belonged to kings and emperors. Now that the kings and emperors have been shot or reduced to pathetic ceremonial posts, the most common reason given for not believing in economic liberty is that the free market is unfair. Socialists, social democrats, American liberals, and all other kinds of economic levelers think that unconstrained industry, agriculture, and commerce lead to the exploitation of people who aren't very good at these things. A little bit of immoral wealth and a great deal of unconscionable poverty is supposedly thereby created. It was Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, published with happy coincidence in 1776, who originally argued that a free market is good for everybody. Smith seems to have been the first person to realize that all voluntary exchanges increase prosperity. Wealth is created by any swap. It may seem like an even trade, but each trader gives up something he values less in order to receive something he values more. Hence, the total wealth of both traders grows. When Neolithic spearmakers did business with Neolithic basket weavers, the spearmakers were able to carry things around in a manner more convenient than skewering them on spear points. And the basket weavers were able to kill mastodons by a method more efficient than swatting them with baskets. The free market outcome benefits all. It's moral. And the beautiful thing about this morality is that we don't have to be good to achieve it. In the most, perhaps only, famous passage from an economics book, Adam Smith states, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. Smith saw that a man's ordinary selfish concern with his own well-being is a desirable, indeed a splendid thing for society. "He intends only his own gain," wrote Smith, "and he is in this led by an invisible hand to promote an end which is no part of his intention." That end is the end this tape is about, economic progress. The general morality of the free market, however, does not answer the specific objection of unfairness. Economic liberty leads to differences in wealth, and the differences are enormous. The wealth gap is the subject of a critical debate about economics. The perception of unfairness is the reason that enormous numbers of the world's decent and well-meaning people, in fact the majority of them, do not rush to embrace the free market in its totality. Complete economic liberty would mean no barriers to trade or capital flow, no barriers to labor flow either, no check on immigration, no minimum wage, no cost controls, and no attempt to create a fair society. This is a daunting prospect, and it's not just the Swedes and Fidel Castro who are daunted by it. Socialists and capitalists naturally take opposing sides on the question of how economically fair life should be. But so do various political parties which claim to be pro-market. So do theologians and philosophers, and so do ordinary people when they're voting for school bond issues or deciding how much to cheat on their taxes. Fairness is a potent emotional issue, but how is fairness to be delivered? It's hard to build a political structure that provides economic fairness. When a government controls both the economic power of individuals and the coercive power of the state, we get Shanghai. A businessman finds that one of his principal stockholders has tanks, artillery, and jet fighter planes. That violates a fundamental rule of happy living. Never let the people with all the money and the people with all the guns be the same people. Accepting the free market allows us to avoid the political abuse and financial mismanagement inherent in trying to design an economy that's fair. It also allows us to see that economies can't be designed. Economics is the measurement of how human nature affects the material world. The market is heartless. So are clocks and yardsticks. Saying that economic problems are the result of the free market's failure is like gaining 20 pounds and calling the bathroom scale a bum. Adam Smith recognized that markets are self-organizing. Man has, wrote Smith, a general disposition to truck, barter, and exchange. If people are protected from coercion by other people, and from coercion by that agglomeration of other people known as the state, human brains and greed create economic growth. Said Smith, "The strength of the mastiff is not in the least supported either by the swiftness of the greyhound or by the sagacity of the spaniel. Among men," he said, "on the contrary, the most dissimilar geniuses are of use to one another." I had thought that economic problems were the result of ignorance about economics. I was wrong again. I ask a friend who's knowledgeable in the field, "Why is the concept of the invisible hand so difficult to comprehend?" He said, "It's invisible." The hardest thing to understand about economics is that it doesn't need to be understood. My beatnik friends and I, when we were in college, were perfectly justified in expending our intellectual energy on love and death instead of money. But there was one thing we did need to learn, and still do. And it's a piece of knowledge that seems to contradict psychology, life experience, and the dictates of conscience. Economics is not zero sum. There is no fixed amount of wealth. That is, if you have too many slices of pizza, I don't have to eat the box. Your money does not cause my poverty. Refusal to believe this is at the bottom of most bad economic thinking. True, at any given moment, there's only so much wealth to go around. But wealth is based on productivity. Without productivity, there wouldn't be any economics, or any economic thinking, good or bad, or any pizza, or anything else. We would sit around and stare at rocks, and maybe later have some for dinner. So, if wealth is not a worldwide round robin of purse snatching, and if the thing that makes you rich doesn't make me poor, why should we care about fairness at all? We shouldn't. Fairness is a good thing in a marriage and at the daycare center. It's a nice little domestic virtue. But a liking for fairness is not that noble a sentiment. Fairness doesn't rank with charity, love, duty, or self-sacrifice. And there's always a tinge of self-seeking in making sure that things are fair. Don't you go trying to get one up on me. As a foundation for a political system, fairness may be no virtue at all. The Old Testament is clear on this point. The Bible may seem an odd place to be doing economic research, especially by someone like me who goes to church about once a year and only then because that's when my wife says the Easter Bunny comes. However, I have been thinking, in socioeconomic terms, about the Tenth Commandment. The first nine commandments concern theological principle and social law. Thou shalt not make graven images, steal, kill, etc. Fair enough. But then there's the Tenth Commandment. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, nor his ass, nor anything that is thy neighbor's. Here are God's basic rules about how we should live, a very brief list of sacred obligations and solemn moral precepts. And right at the end of it is, don't envy your buddy's cow. What is that doing in there? Why would God, with just 10 things to tell Moses, choose as one of them jealousy about the livestock next door? And yet think about how important to the well-being of a community this commandment is. If you want a donkey, if you want a pot roast, if you want a cleaning lady, don't bitch about what the people across the street have. Go get your own. The Tenth Commandment sends a message to socialists, to egalitarians, to people obsessed with fairness, to American presidential candidates in the year 2000, to everyone who believes that wealth should be redistributed. And the message is clear and concise. Go to hell. If we want the whole world to be rich, we need to start loving wealth. In the difference between poverty and plenty, the problem is the poverty, not the difference. Wealth is good. You know this about your own wealth. If you got rich, it would be a great thing. You'd improve your life, you'd improve your family's life, you'd purchase education, travel, knowledge about the world. You'd invest in worthwhile things. You'd give money to noble causes. You'd help your friends and neighbors. Your life would be better if you got rich. The lives of the people around you would be better. Your wealth is good. So why isn't everybody's wealth good? Wealth is good when a lot of people have it. It's good when a few people have it. This is because money is a tool, nothing more. You can't eat or drink money or wear it very comfortably as underwear. And wealth, an accumulation of money, is a bunch of tools. Tools can be used to do harm. You can break into a house by throwing a drill press through a window. You can hit somebody over the head with a hydroelectric turbine. Tools are still good. When a carpenter has a lot of tools, we don't say to him, "You have too many. You should give some of your hammers, saws, screws, and nails to the guy who's cooking omelets." Making money through hard work and wise investment is a fine thing to do. Other ways of making money aren't so bad either, as long as everybody who's in on the deal is there voluntarily. Better sleazy productivity than none. As terrible as Albania's pyramid schemes were, Albania's riots were worse. And Hong Kong shows that even the most resolutely free market system makes use of private means for the public good. If the United States radically reduced the size of its government, eliminated all subsidies, price controls, and corporate welfare, and abolished its entitlement programs, we'd still pay taxes. And those tax revenues would be spent, ideally, on such reasonable things as schools, roads, and national defense in case the British invade again and try to hand over Wall Street to the Red Chinese. Or take the real-world example of two kids who graduate from college with honors. One is an admirable idealist. The other's on the make. The idealist joins Friends of the Earth and chains himself to a sequoia. The Sharpie goes to work for an investment bank selling fishy derivatives and makes $500,000 a year. Even assuming that the selfish young banker cheats the IRS, and he will, he'll end up paying $100,000 a year in taxes, income tax, property tax, sales tax, etc. While the admirable idealist has saved one tree, if the logging company doesn't own bolt cutters, the pirate in a necktie has contributed to society $100,000 worth of schools, roads, and U.S. Marines, not to mention Interior Department funding, sufficient to save any number of trees and the young idealist chained there too. And if the soulless yuppie cheats the IRS so well that he ends up keeping the whole $500,000, that cash isn't going to sit in his sock drawer. Whether spent or saved, the money winds up invested somewhere. and maybe that investment leads to the creation of the 21st century's equivalent of the moldboard plow or the microchip or the mocha latte. Society wins. Wealth brings great benefits to the world. Rich people are heroes. They don't usually mean to be, but that's their problem, not ours. Almost everyone in the world now admits that the free market tells us the economic truth. Economic liberty makes wealth. Economic repression makes poverty. Poverty is hard, wretched, humiliating. But what poverty is not is sad. Poverty is infuriating. These things don't have to happen. These conditions don't need to exist. We know exactly how to get rid of poverty. We know precisely how to create wealth. But because of laziness, fear, complacency, love of power, or foolish idealism, we refuse to do it. We think we can dabble in freedom, allow a few of its liberties, and leave our favorite constraints in place. We think we can screw around with the free market, skip its costs, and get all of its benefits anyway. There's a joke that I think President Reagan used to tell to illustrate the stupid attitude that some people have towards the blessings they get from freedom and private property. Or if Reagan didn't tell the joke, he should have. He won't mind the attribution. Doubtless he's forgotten all about economics by now. And I'm with the president on that. I intend to start forgetting as much economics as possible as soon as I can. Keeping in mind, however, a few rudimentary concepts, such as the one about the traveling salesman who's staying overnight with a farm family. When the family sits down to eat, there's a pig seated at the table. The pig has three medals hanging around its neck and a wooden leg. The salesman says, I see a pig is having dinner with you. Yep, says the farmer. That's because he's a very special pig. You see those medals around his neck? Well, the first medal is from when our baby son fell in the pond. That pig dove in and saved his life. The second medal, that's from when our little daughter was trapped in a burning barn. That pig carried her out and saved her life. And the third medal, that's from when our oldest boy was cornered by a mean bull. That pig bit the bull's tail and saved the boy's life. Yes, says the salesman, I can see why you let that pig sit right at the table and have dinner with you. And I can see why you awarded him the medals. But how did he get the wooden leg? Well, says the farmer, pig like that, you don't eat them all at once.
Another title by P.J. O'Rourke, available on audio from Random House, is Parliament of Whores, read by William H. Macy. This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.